next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Music and Memories, followed by USA Today at 2. Starting Monday on the Noon Book Hour, Extraordinary Ordinary People, a memoir of family written and narrated by Condoleezza Rice. Condoleezza Rice has excelled as a diplomat, political scientist, and concert pianist. Her achievements run the gamut from helping to oversee the collapse of communism in Europe and the decline of the Soviet Union, to working to protect the country in the aftermath of 9/11, to becoming only the second woman and the first black woman ever to serve as Secretary of State. In the 50s, Birmingham's black middle class largely succeeded in insulating their children from the most corrosive effects of racism. Condoleezza's father, John, a minister and educator, instilled in her a love of sports and politics. Her mother, a teacher, developed Condoleezza's passion for piano and exposed her to the fine arts. From both, Rice learned the value of faith in the face of hardship and the importance of giving back to the community. Extraordinary Ordinary People, a memoir of family written and narrated by Condoleezza Rice. Starting Monday at noon and Tuesday at 2 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 27 and mostly cloudy. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the low 30s. Then tomorrow, partly cloudy with a high in the low 30s. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the mid-20s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
Good afternoon. Welcome to your coronavirus update for Thursday, February 11th, 2021, from the Recording Library of West Texas. I'm Michael. One note, I will be taking off most of Thursday and all of Friday. So our reports this Thursday and Friday will be pre-recorded reports from the Texas Standard and a few reports from NPR. One thing I do want to note is that as of Thursday morning at 10 a.m., the CVS pharmacies in Texas are now accepting appointments. The website is very busy, so you may have to wait a while. For updates and information, as well as to book an appointment, you can visit CVS.com. You can use the CVS Pharmacy app, or you can call CVS at 800-746-7287. Once again, that number is 800-746-7287. Looking at the status of the CVS website insofar as which cities are fully booked and which are available, the good news is most of the cities in West Texas at 10 a.m. on Thursday, February 11th, are still available for booking. That includes Midland, Odessa, Lubbock, Abilene, and San Angelo. We will return with our regular format for this program on Monday. Now, here are our pre-recorded reports.
From Midland to Marfa, Dalhart to Dallas. No matter where you're listening, it's the Texas Standard for this Wednesday, February 10th. I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. And all across the state, we've heard from Texans who are trying to get the COVID-19 vaccine. Some of these messages are success stories. Take this example from Linda Cuellar of Pipe Creek, who had luck after switching providers.
And immediately received my first vaccine. I'll be getting the second one in a couple of weeks.
Others are mixed, like for Lori Jacques in El Paso.
Now my concern is that there won't be second dose available to me, or my second dose will be delayed.
But many are filled with frustration and confusion, the inability to get on a list at all, or that by the time an appointment is finally made, there are no doses available. Austinite Margaret Dahl is 76 and says though she's had success signing up, she tries several times a day to actually get an appointment. So far, no luck. We're collecting these stories, good, bad, in between, in an effort to paint a picture of what the vaccine distribution process is looking like all across Texas. And we want to hear your story. We'll talk more about how you can share it with us in a few minutes, but first, we want to try to get some expert answers. What everyone in Texas seems to want to know is when there's only a limited supply of vaccine, how does the state decide where the doses go? Dr. Ryan Van Ramshorst is a San Antonio pediatrician and chief medical director for the state's Texas Medicaid and Children's Health Insurance Program. But he's here today wearing another hat. He's one of 17 members of the Texas COVID-19 Expert Vaccine Allocation Panel, which is made up of state lawmakers and health professionals. Dr. Van Ramshorst, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hi, good morning. Thanks. It's great to be with you.
So how does vaccine distribution work? I guess, can you start with the federal to state handoff?
Yes. So Texas, in addition with other states, is partnering with the federal government to make sure that vaccines are distributed. And the federal government allocates a certain percentage of vaccine to states based on their population largely. And then the state determines which providers those vaccines will be allocated to. But the federal government ships those vaccines directly to the providers. So the Department of State Health Services is involved again in planning the allocation, but those vaccines are shipped directly to the providers that will be giving them to Texans.
Okay, so there's no holding period here, but the state does decide which providers get how many. How does that process work? And I'm sure you're looking at which city these providers are in.
Yeah, so the Expert Vaccine Allocation Panel very early on developed what we call our guiding principles to make sure that we are doing right by Texans with the allocation plan. And we take into consideration the size of communities, the ability of those providers to get vaccines to Texans. We currently have this week 358 different Texas providers, but 85 of those providers are what we call hub providers that are public facing, high throughput, and not just vaccinating the specific city or town where they might be located, but the surrounding community as well to get as many shots in arms as possible, because that's one of the things that we really need right now.
And it sounds like the state left it up to these providers to decide how they were going to make their lists and how they were going to get these shots in arms. Have you heard very wildly different success stories and places having a harder time?
So we know that there are some areas that are performing very highly and have found ways to keep things very simplified and orderly. And we know that there's other providers that are facing challenges. And so I know that the Department of State Health Services is actively outreaching to those providers to help them level up their plans and make sure they're getting as many vaccines to Texans as they can. But I do want to point out that the vaccine providers themselves are not able to create their own list. The Expert Vaccine Allocation Panel developed a phased prioritization, if you will, determined by our guiding principles in terms of who should be eligible first for the vaccine, and I'm happy to elaborate on that.
Yeah, let's talk about that at that point now. So the CDC recommendation, if I understand it, was to start vaccinating individuals age 75 and older, but Texas opened up that category wider, as I understand it, to those 65 and older and to those over the age of 16 with certain health conditions. Is that right?
It is, and the Expert Vaccine Allocation Panel, of course, looked to guidance from our federal partners, but also took into consideration the feedback that we were getting from Texans. And so we started with phase 1A, which included residents of long-term care facilities, staff in long-term care facilities, and our frontline healthcare workers directly interacting with patients. And then phase 1B, as you mentioned, is individuals 65 years of age and older, and individuals 16 years in age of older with one or more chronic medical conditions that makes them higher risk for getting very sick from COVID. And as you mentioned, we have had a very specific emphasis on individuals 75 years of age and older, because we know that the older someone is, the higher their risk is from getting very sick.
So we know there's nearly 4 million Texans over the age of 65, but does the panel have an idea of how many people qualify in this over 16 with specific health conditions category?
Yeah, so we estimate that for phase 1B for the entire state of Texas, it's about 11.5 million individuals, which is a lot of Texans. But I'm happy to say that we estimate that 30% of Texans 65 years of age and older have received at least one dose.
We know that COVID-19 has especially devastated communities of color, but we've also heard reports they're having a harder time getting vaccines. Has there been any discussion about this on the panel or how to get those vaccines to those areas better?
Yes, one of our guiding principles is specifically around mitigating health inequities. We know that the pandemic has exacerbated or made worse health disparities that have existed in Texas communities for many, many years. And so the panel is very aware of this. I really think that this issue is one where we need to support our local communities to partner with faith-based organizations, community-based organizations, to make sure that we are reaching out to those underserved communities, rural communities, communities of color, and otherwise to make sure that they're able to get those vaccines as well.
We're hearing a lot about second doses being in scarce supply. What can you tell folks feeling antsy that they might not receive theirs on schedule?
Yeah, so the vast majority of people have gotten their second doses on time, so that's a good thing. And we are working with providers to make sure that they continue to understand the process for making sure that second dose is ordered and will be received on time to give people that second dose. But we have heard concerns from individuals who are worried, just like you stated, and we continue to work specifically one-on-one with those providers to make sure that we're minimizing that from happening as much as possible.
I mean, I think the biggest complaint I hear is frustration, you know? I mean, the people who get through are grateful. They say once that they are on the list that the process is pretty quick, but sometimes for many of these people, getting on the list has been the hardest challenge. I'm guessing your advice is be patient, but I think that feels so hard when people feel like their lives are literally on the line here.
We have heard lots of comments from Texans about the frustration, and it is real. I know that so many individuals are working hard to improve this process, but I hear this frustration from some of my own patients who are concerned, who are worried, who want to get the vaccine to protect themselves and their loved ones and their communities. I think being patient is really important. You know, right now, this is still a very scarce resource, and we're all looking to the coming months where there will hopefully be much more vaccine to go around. But I think one thing to keep in mind is we know that those tested and true Healthy Texas steps, as we call them, of watching one's distance, watching one's hands, and wearing a mask can help stem the tide of COVID before someone gets a vaccine and after they get a vaccine. And so I would ask that Texans be patient, and we know that this is a challenging process. I think one of the other groups that we want to make sure that we are specifically reaching out to are those individuals that have difficulty accessing the internet for whatever reason. We know that many of the hub sites are relying on online registration because there's some advantages with that, but we know that there are certain populations that don't have a computer, they don't have a smart device. Maybe it's an individual with intellectual or developmental disabilities that has difficulty accessing something online, and so we are working and strategizing about how to specifically reach out to those populations.
Dr. Ryan Van Ramshorst is a member of the Texas COVID-19 Expert Vaccine Allocation Panel. Dr. Van Ramshorst, thank you again.
Thank you so much.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. You know, throughout the pandemic, we've been talking with Dr. Fred Campbell to get some common sense advice on the coronavirus. He's a doctor of internal medicine and associate professor of medicine at the Long School of Medicine, UT Health San Antonio. Dr. Campbell, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
It's great to be back, David.
Of course, I said common sense advice. Your knowledge goes way beyond common sense, and that's one of the reasons we want to ask you these questions. This week, a lot of the questions we've received are related to advice concerning the vaccine and not the virus itself. And this first one asks, if I've received both doses of the COVID-19 vaccine, how soon can I be in contact with my grandkids, and do I need to follow any social distance procedures?
Well, as a grandparent myself, I can certainly sympathize with the listener. The vaccines have been extremely effective, but unfortunately, because of the continued prevalence of COVID-19 infection in the community, it is very important to continue the same kind of social distancing and masking that has been advised throughout the pandemic.
Doctor, could you explain that a little bit more in detail? Because I think some people believe if you've gotten the vaccine, you are going to be immune from the virus, and presumably you're not going to be a carrier, or is that last part wrong?
Well, the vaccines are extremely effective, but in high-risk individuals, particularly our seniors, there is no guarantee that even vaccine will be completely effective until such time as the overall prevalence of infections in the community have dropped to a substantial low point.
This next question deals with donating blood after being vaccinated. A listener writes, if I have had the vaccine, will my blood have the convalescent plasma that can be used to treat COVID patients? What's known about that, Dr. Campbell?
Well, again, the listener is quite true that the production of neutralizing antibodies does occur with vaccination against COVID-19, very similar to what's found in survivors of COVID-19 infection. And so using that kind of plasma could be as effective as convalescent plasma. To my knowledge, the studies have not started yet to look at that particular idea, but it is possible that we'll be using that kind of plasma in the future for treatment of COVID patients.
We've talked about the importance of maintaining social distance procedures, even if you have had the vaccination, but I'm wondering if we can speak a little bit more generally here. A question here is, are there any spaces vaccinated people should still try to avoid for health and safety purposes? I think this goes to where you might actually be free to go, or where you should specifically sort of think of yourself as, well, that's a place you definitely should not go.
Again, I would very much encourage people to continue to use outdoor spaces for things like exercise. It is much less likely that someone will pick up COVID infection outside than in an enclosed, crowded area, such as a building, but also, of course, modes of transportation can be a problem because of the inability to prevent crowding and possible transmission.
It sounds like there's a thread running through a lot of this, Dr. Campbell, and that is that even if you've had the vaccine, still don't modify your behavior from what we've been doing over the past several months. In other words, continue to use face masks, maintain social distancing until at least the time where we've reached something closer to herd immunity.
That's correct. At this point, we still have seniors and high-risk individuals that could have serious infections or even die from COVID between now and the time where public health officials can tell us that the prevalence is so low that there is an acceptable risk.
We've been talking with Dr. Fred Campbell. He's a doctor of internal medicine at the Long School at UT Health San Antonio, and he's been speaking with us regularly over the course of the pandemic, answering listener questions. If you have something you'd like to ask about the virus or the vaccine, look for us on Twitter, Facebook, or go over to texasstandard.org/coronavirus. You'll find a form right there to submit your questions. Dr. Campbell, thanks so much for speaking with us again.
Thank you, David. It's always a pleasure.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard.
After a massive surge this fall and winter, new daily coronavirus cases in the U.S. have dropped dramatically, and COVID hospitalizations have plummeted by more than 50,000 in under a month. Will Stone reports on what experts think is going on.
The waning winter surge is not a mirage. The last time cases were this low, it was the beginning of November. When Dr. David Rubin looks at pandemic numbers across the U.S.,
it's hard to find a county that has me concerned. That's pretty striking.
Rubin runs the COVID modeling group at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He says respiratory viruses typically surge during colder months and then begin to wane. And coronavirus appears to be doing the same.
We're not out of the woods yet, but we're seeing a natural curve here over winter that reflects the seasonality of this virus.
But that doesn't explain everything. In some places, people are being more careful. In others, there's higher immunity because so many people got infected.
And so it plays out very locally, but we've reached this equilibrium, and now we have these factors that are playing into our favor.
Those factors include longer days, warmer temperatures, at least in some parts of the U.S., and not as many big national holidays. And about the holidays, Ali Maqdad at the University of Washington has some good news.
Americans did really behave during the holidays.
Yes, there were still millions of people who flew, but Maqdad says the metrics they track show people not only traveled less, but they seemed to stay put once they got somewhere.
The week after Thanksgiving, dead silence. Even cell phone calls went down.
Now, clearly some places did have a spike due to travel and family gatherings. But generally, the so-called surge on top of a surge was not as bad as expected. Mask wearing, social distancing, Maqdad says those improved as the situation got more dire in America's hospitals. The question is,
will Americans behave the same way as the cases are coming down? Because they behaved well when the cases were going up.
It's difficult to rank what is most responsible for the nationwide drop in infection. But Natalie Dean at the University of Florida sees behavior as a major reason.
Just the speed at how quickly things are turning around, that to me indicates that people may be responding a bit to what they see locally in their communities, what they're hearing on the news.
Millions of people getting vaccinated helps, but Dean says it's still early for that to be having a huge impact. Dr. Sarita Shaw at Emory University agrees.
Even though the numbers have been decreasing, there are several things that could very quickly send the cases soaring again.
That would be too quickly relaxing restrictions, just as new, more contagious variants of the virus pick up speed in the U.S.
You know, this is not the time to get complacent and lower our guard.
She says cases and hospitalizations are still way higher than they were during last summer. At Larry's Tavern in Seattle, owner Joel Stedman is hoping the positive trend continues. His bar was closed for months and just reopened a few weeks ago, but only at the 25% capacity the state allows.
We're not here to scare anybody off. Just fill up the handful of tables we have and make sure it's a good time for those that are here.
Sitting in the booth with Joel is his wife, Margot.
We've closed down and started up and closed down and gotten our hopes up and been let down so many times that we are cautiously optimistic.
The lull has the Stedmans dreaming of late spring and summer. What Joel thinks of as...
I call it normal adjacent. And I think that with vaccine rollout, you'll start to see consumer confidence rising slowly but surely.
So far, more than 33 million Americans have received at least one shot of coronavirus vaccines. For NPR News, I'm Will Stone.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. Public education advocates continue to push for Texas's teachers to be a priority when it comes to receiving COVID-19 vaccines. While several other states across the U.S. have bumped public school teachers up in the vaccine line, considering them as frontline workers, so far Texas hasn't done the same. Ovidia Molina is president of the Texas State Teachers Association. Ovidia, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
Texas teachers over aged 65 or with an underlying health condition are, of course, already eligible for the vaccine. Why do you think all Texas public school teachers need to be prioritized?
Well, we believe that all educators, all school personnel have to have priority access if we are to ensure safe, equitable, and effective way of teaching in person, which is what the state is pushing all of our schools to do.
Now, obviously, your group is focused on teachers, but you mentioned other school personnel there. You know, I'm thinking bus drivers, lunch staff, should they be treated with the same priority?
Definitely. As educators, we know that it's not just the teacher that creates the atmosphere and the successes for our students. It's everybody that works in our schools. It's the person walking down the hall that says hello to them, the cafeteria worker that makes their lunches and speaks to them, checks on them to see how they're doing. I mean, we all have a great impact on our students, and none of us would be able to do the job without the other.
Do we have data right now on Texas teachers who have been sickened or even lost their lives from COVID-19?
Unfortunately, the frustrating part for our educators is how the state is reporting cases that are occurring in our school systems. It's all self-reported by the district. And so we have to figure out who got COVID in a school building. And that's how the school district is going to report it. If for some reason they think that you didn't catch it at school, then maybe it's not going to report it. So the fear is also that we may not be seeing the numbers that are actual numbers for how many educators and students are getting COVID at school, because we don't have clear guidelines as to what that means. Every district is going to have a different way of doing it, because every district has their own set of rules. And so as educators, we don't even know if what the data is telling us is true. What we do know is that we have friends, we have coworkers, we have people that we know that have gotten COVID. We have educators across the street from us that are having to be tested. And then the fear comes back. Oh my gosh, how long did I talk to them? Where were we? What happened? Who needs to be tested? I'm not safe is the feeling that we have constantly.
Can I circle back to something that you mentioned, which is that you're not asking for a mandate? What are you hearing from teachers, and are you hearing from some who are, you know, resistant to the idea of being vaccinated? Do you think there's a need for some vaccine education there?
There's definitely a need for vaccine education with everybody, because we have groups, you know, within our schools, or within our parent communities, right? That are saying, oh, that's not what you need. Vaccines aren't going to help. They're not what's going to happen to make us all come back in person. And the reality is that most of our educators want access, because they want peace of mind. They want to be able to come home and not feel like they're bringing something home to their families. They're also wanting to make sure that their students feel safe when they go into their classrooms, into the hallways. And so education needs to happen at all levels. But the fact that we don't have access to the vaccines when we want to have access to them is what's also creating an issue. The fact that some educators are being able to get the vaccine and some are not.
Ovidia Molina is president of the Texas State Teachers Association. Ovidia, thank you again.
Thank you. Have a good day.
33 minutes past the hour. It's Texas Standard Time, and I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. The Dell Medical School at UT Austin has been testing out a program that could help combat the health effects of loneliness and isolation, particularly among older people. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports public health officials say loneliness has become a growing public health concern that is more urgent during the pandemic.
Didi Diaz is calling up a man named Earl. He's in his late 70s.
Hello.
Hi, Earl.
Yes.
Hi, Earl. This is Didi.
Yeah, Didi. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Well, doing pretty good.
Didi and Earl haven't talked in a bit, so there's a lot to catch up on. One of Earl's granddaughters recently got married. Another granddaughter had a baby. It came a little early, he says. He also talked about a small medical procedure he had recently. It went well. The conversation then turns to weather. It's getting colder, so the leaves from the trees around his yard are starting to fall. Earl tells Didi about that, too.
I've got an ash tree in front, so I've been dealing with it.
Okay.
And then the neighbor's key. Then backyard, the neighbor's trees, they blow in my yard.
This call is like any other conversation you'd hear between friends, except it's a little more one-sided. It's mostly about Earl. It's about what has happened in his life, what he's thinking about, what his days are like, including the most mundane details. Didi started these calls with Earl as a volunteer for the Sunshine Calls program. This program serves older adults who are often homebound and therefore pretty isolated in their daily lives. How often they get a phone call varies depending on the person. And the point of the calls is to get these individuals to just talk about themselves.
The focus is really about making the person on the other end feel that it is a time of their own, that it is a time of their priorities, their choices, their interests.
That's Minnie Callon. She's the executive director of Factor Health at Dell Medical School, which is a lead in this project. She says the program uses empathy as a sort of medical intervention for people facing loneliness and isolation. Kailan says these simple conversations can eventually, hopefully, have a big effect on how people feel about their own lives.
And in that way, make them feel for that moment, and hopefully it carries forward, that their past matters, their present matters, and what they feel about the future matters.
This project is a partnership between DelMed and Meals on Wheels of Central Texas. Meals on Wheels is a national group that distributes meals to older Americans. Adam Hauser is the president and CEO of Central Texas's chapter. He says isolation has been an issue among the people they serve for a long time.
It's not uncommon for many of our clients, if they didn't have a daily visit from Meals on Wheels volunteer, they wouldn't see anyone else.
Hauser says isolation and the depression and anxiety that can be caused by isolation has been a public health concern for a while now. But he says the pandemic has been like sort of an x-ray on this problem. Hauser says everyone can just see it a little clearer now.
I guess you could say this is one of the sort of good things to come out of the pandemic, is that people are starting to realize that older adults have very complex and significant needs.
And Minnie Callon with DelMed says these needs have become greater and more urgent during the pandemic. So far, the program has already served more than 100 people.
There's absolutely no question that with COVID and the increased isolation of folks, the interest in loneliness has ratcheted up. No question about it.
Callon says that's why DelMed also began conducting a study on the program. Researchers checked in with people between July and September of last year. They measured whether these sunshine calls had made them feel less isolated, less left out, and like they had companionship in their life. Callon says if they can prove these calls made measurable differences, it could be a useful tool in the fight against isolation.
It's one of several potential solutions that will then be available to folks as they think about how to intervene, not just screen for and recognize that the issue exists.
Adam Hauser with Meals on Wheels says it's more important than ever for people to tackle this problem as a major public health issue. He says isolation can affect someone's physical health as well as their emotional health.
Loneliness and depression and feelings of isolation, in our view, are viruses just like COVID, and can have just as devastating health impacts, particularly on seniors and older adults.
DelMed researchers are currently working to get the results of their study published as soon as possible so the program can be replicated elsewhere.
In Austin, I'm Ashley Lopez.
This has been your coronavirus update for Thursday, February 11th, 2021, from the Recording Library of West Texas. Stay tuned for the magazine Healthy Living, followed by USA Today with national news at 2 and our local newspaper broadcast at 3. More national news with the Wall Street Journal at 6. And then at 7 o'clock tonight, we welcome you to our first new broadcast of the week from Texas Monthly Archives, which will also run throughout the weekend. This week's theme is Valentine's, so it's stories about love and togetherness. That's again on Texas Monthly Archives, as well as Sunday afternoon at 2 and Monday morning at 1 a.m. Thank you for joining us.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland, Odessa area. It's 28 with fog. Tonight it will be cloudy with a low in the mid-30s. Then tomorrow, cloudy with a high in the mid-30s. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the mid-20s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas.
This program is made available to the IAAIS Program Share and was recorded at the Audio Reading Service of the Ellen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana, for people with print impairments.
Welcome. This is Healthy Life, and I'm your reader, Tony Ray, with the Audio Reading Service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today I'll be reading from Health, and I'll start with an article called Optimize Your Home Health Toolkit. We've gone from not even knowing what a pulse oximeter or a UV light sanitizer is to Googling the best prices. What other products and meds do you need or not in your 2021 Health Toolkit? Take this quiz and see if your knowledge or what you're using needs an update. Do you know your meds? Here's your first one. Uh-oh, the thermometer says you're in fever turf. Better reach for A, Tylenol, B, Advil or Motrin, C, nothing. The fever needs to run its course. I'll let you think. A, Tylenol. A fever's job is to make your body inhospitable to the germs invading it, but you don't need to let a temperature run rampant. Studies have shown that a fever reducer won't delay recovery, but can reduce misery. Acetaminophen edges out ibuprofen, says Crystal Zhao, pharmacy. D, a assistant clinical professor of pharmacy at the University of California, San Francisco, who says it's safer to take. If your fever tops 103, call a doc. Next question. You need your cough, hack, cough, repeat to stop, like right now. A, cough suppressant, B, expectorant, or C, antibiotics. The answer is B, an expectorant. An expectorant loosens up the phlegm so it's easier to cough up, says Zhao. Look for products with guaifenesin, such as Mucinex SE. Suppressants, such remove the itch that makes you want to cough. And together, these ingredients work against each other, says Zhao. So you'll want to skip the combo products such as Robitussin Honey Cough plus Chest Congestant DM. And don't be tempted by antibiotics. They don't kill viruses which cause colds and COVID-19. Number three. Which is better for a runny nose? A, nose drops. B, decongestants you take by mouth. The answer is B, decongestants you take by mouth. Oral decongestants effectively constrict the blood vessels in your nose, relieving the runniness and also stuffiness. Nose drops, aka nasal sprays, do that too, but can cause rebound congestion if you use them for more than 3 days in a row, sometimes making your nose feel stuffier than before. The spray, stuffiness, spray routine can become a vicious cycle that's hard to break. Nose drops made of just saline, such as Ocean, won't do that, but they don't work for everybody. Number four, you did legs for the first time in months. Ouch, and ibuprofen might, and then you're going to pick which one, choose which apply, let you walk comfortably, B, reduce your gains, C, take down your risk of injury. Well, the answer is A and B, let you walk comfortably and reduce your gains. If you're sore after one workout and take an Advil, it's fine and can potentially help your muscles be less sore, says Brad Schoffenfield, PhD, CSCS at the Lehman College. But hitting repeat on anti-inflammatory pills, also naproxen and aspirin, too often can stop you from heaping and reaping strength gains. The acute inflammatory response that happens after training signals your body to repair and strengthens the muscle. Chronically using these meds blunts that. Okay, well, let's check your germ IQ. Here's the fifth question. The absolute best microbiologist-approved way to clean your hands is with A, soap, B, hand sanitizer, and C, both. The answer is both. If you wash your hands for 20 seconds with regular soap, that's all you need. Thing is, nobody really does that, not even now. Most people only wash their hands for about 11 seconds. That's why it's better to wash your hands and follow it up with some hand sanitizer that's at least 70% alcohol, just to be safe. Products with less alcohol may not kill all the germs. Okay, here's the sixth one. The best way to get the germs on your doorknob from infecting you is with A, home UV sanitizing wand, B, any basic cleaning product, and C, an antibacterial or disinfecting cleaning product. And the answer is C, I bet you got that. While UV light works well for hospital disinfection, home UV wands aren't as effective, nor are they typically regulated. And regular spray cleaner doesn't do anything to viruses or bacteria. Products with the words antibacterial or disinfecting will actually kill them. But for these products to really work, you have to leave them on the surface for about 10 minutes, which you, as a busy person, do not really have time for. You can use antibacterial wipes and let the residue dry on its own. Number 7, assess your health monitor IQ. If your wearables show a heart rate that's higher than usual in the morning, it might mean, okay, choose the ones that apply. You're having a heart attack, A, B, you're about to get sick, or C, you should kick your workout back today. The answer is B and C. You're about to get sick and you should kick your workout back today. The stress of a hard workout or fighting off illness may cause your heart rate to go up. And fevers may increase heart rate up to 20 beats per minute for every degree of temperature above normal. A heart attack wouldn't be likely to show up on a heart rate monitor. If you suspect you're having one, you need to be diagnosed and see a doctor, not a smartwatch. Number 8, your blood pressure is all over the place because you checked it. Okay, which ones apply? A, after working out, B, after drinking coffee, C, with your arm on a low surface, and D, scrolling Twitter. The answer is all of them. A lot of factors can contribute to blood pressure going up and down, and doing just one thing wrong can affect readings. To avoid mistakes above that I just mentioned and get a better read, wait 30 minutes after a workout or coffee, sit still with your arm at your heart height and back supported, feet flat on the floor, and take a break from stressful strolling. Number 9, you should be monitoring your blood oxygen saturation on a pulse oximeter daily, A, B, if you're having COVID-19 symptoms, and C, never. And guess what? The answer is never, number C. When news came out that some people with COVID-19 had low oxygen saturation levels, even if they didn't have a hard time breathing, there was a run on pulse oximeters. But oxygen stats aren't magic numbers. Some people with low levels are pretty healthy, while others need hospitalization. And sometimes a dip is due to how you're wearing the device. A better way to know if you need a hospital, go if you're having trouble breathing, and don't wait. So here's the bonus round, true or false. After exposure to someone with COVID-19, gargling with hydrogen peroxide or putting hand sanitizer under your nose can help you avoid getting sick. True or false? It's false. You have to be preventative with COVID-19 rather than reactive. A 1% hydrogen peroxide gargle can help reduce viral burden in the mouth, making dental work safer for dentists, but it won't help you after you've been exposed. And applying hand sanitizer under your nose may just put more germs on your face. Well, now we're going to hear from Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert. And this is how he keeps his immune system in shape. When the number of COVID-19 cases exploded last year, so did the number of products and services promising to bolster your immunity. You shouldn't get away from talk of IV vitamin infusions, mushroom extracts, and drinkable immune-boosting shots. You also couldn't get away from Dr. Fauci, who became a household name after 4 decades of trying to make sure Americans don't get sick. Ever the straight shooter, he explains that you can't buy a good immune system. If you don't smoke and only drink in moderation, you get a good night's sleep, you have a healthy diet, you exercise, and you do something to reduce stress, that's going to keep your immune system healthy. Not any of these dietary supplements and herbs and other things. How he takes his own advice. Do what you have to do, then de-stress. I can't alleviate stress during the day because my day is one big stress period from morning to evening, Dr. Fauci says. So when I get home in the evening, I do a power walk for about 3.5 to 4 miles, and that generally decompresses my stress. The other day, I was walking along Massachusetts Ave, and son of a gun, I saw a fox run out of somebody's yard into the woods. Know the exception to the vitamins won't help refrain. When Dr. Fauci mentioned in September that he takes vitamin D and that low levels of the vitamin affect your susceptibility to infection, people heard, I take D, as you should take D. Now, how it goes, if you are deficient in D, then taking vitamin D supplements is important. If you have normal levels, it doesn't make any difference, he says, but a doc can check your level via a blood test. Start with a good breakfast. While no specific foods boost your immunity, Dr. Fauci says, an overall balanced diet can help you stay healthy. He aims for balance, but sometimes errs in the timing. He can forget to eat dinner unless his wife reminds him, so he gets the day off to a good start with a pretty consistent healthy breakfast, usually pomegranate juice and an egg white on an English muffin. Lunch is light. Busy nights can mean a takeout salad or a salmon burger. Sleep, or at least a nap. We're going to give the doc a bit of a pass on his own advice here, since his sleep took a hit to lower the disease hit for the rest of us. When COVID-19 spiked, I was getting a ridiculous amount of sleep, like 3 to 4 hours a night. Now I get anywhere between 5 and 6, which is not bad, he says, but it's not optimal. On the occasion he has a half hour between appointments, I'll lie on my couch in my office and take a power nap. Keep COVID-19 away. Dr. Fauci wears a mask, washes his hands all the time, and compulsively sanitizes them. If you're getting tired of being cautious, you have to realize the seriousness of the situation. At press time, the U.S. had more than 250,000 deaths, and the end is not in sight. That's enough incentive to be diligent, I think. But he knows it's hard. Don't be discouraged. I think you should realize that it will end. Hang in there, says Dr. Fauci. Give more, live more. This is change for the better thinking. Doing good can make you feel great. It's also great for your health, and there are lots of ways to give without opening your wallet. Some call it the helper's high, others warm glow giving. Whatever name you attach to the sensation, a growing body of evidence indicates that doing good for others can actually make you feel better, and that's just the start of how your perspective may begin to change. The helper's high is linked to a flood of mood-enhancing chemicals released in your brain during the act of kindness. While the novelty of simple pleasures like food and sex is shown to wear off quickly, this rush seems to be endlessly on tap. There's even evidence that altruistic behavior may boost your tolerance of minor and chronic pains. Perhaps that's because we're hardwired to recognize that community building is one of the cornerstones of modern civilization. Donating your time, experience, or even cold hard cash can bring joy to others, be a release, build bonds with more people, and, especially as you see the change in others' lives, fill your own life with a broader purpose. It is a happiness that lasts, partly because it's creating meaning in your own life, says Emma Sepla, PhD, a director at Stanford University Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education. Over time, that may result in health gains, too. Researchers in the UK found that people who volunteered at least once a month reported better mental health than those who gave less. And a recent Harvard study shows that adults over 50 who volunteered at least 100 hours per week, that's less than 2 hours each week, had a reduced risk of mortality. greater physical activity, and fewer depressive symptoms compared with their peers. Even if you're short on money, time, or attention, there are still plenty of ways to pay it forward in 2021. Here are a few people that are making a difference. Give skills. Armin Henderson, MD, 35, physician, homeless advocate in Miami, Florida. Everybody says they go into medicine to help people. I'm in the hospital 7 nights a week, and then I have 7 days off, but outside the hospital is where I feel like a doctor the most. We have a disease relief coalition made up of several nonprofits, including the one I started in 2018 called Dade County Street Response. Miami goes through a crisis every year with hurricane season, and the government does not respond well to vulnerable communities like our unsheltered population. When the pandemic hit, we started giving out tents, food, and toiletries. We were treating wounds and doing COVID-19 tests. We set up a full-service bathroom site so people could use the toilet and take a shower. These are the life extenders, sometimes on the order of 15 years if people have access. I think I suffer from a mild case of depression. Doing the work that I do in my community is like therapy. This is a way to get physicians into the community where I think things really matter. So if you want to take action with this, reach out to a volunteer network like taprootfoundation.org or catchafire.org. They match your skills to nonprofits that need help in everything from finance and web design to marketing and strategy. Okay, how about giving some time? Jose Centero, 46, Los Angeles, California, is a chef and restaurateur and free meal maker. A week into the pandemic, we decided to close all the restaurants and furlough or lay off employees so they could get a jump start with unemployment before the bad stuff happened. Despite my being distraught about everything that was happening, my friend introduced me to Lola Gulandini, who co-founded a nonprofit called Dine 11 with her close friend Chris Say. They began by donating meals to hospitals all over LA, especially to those with less funding. So for over 2 months, I would cook 2 or 3 days a week, providing more than 1,000 meals. Being able to do this gave me purpose, and I was glad I was able to help in any small way that I could. So I found prepping and cooking in solitude calming for me in very uncertain times. Sometimes that's lacking a lot right now. But what is lacking now is common decency. Just trying to take care of people in any way that you can. How to take action? Local food banks and soup kitchens often need support, especially now. VolunteerMatch.org lets you search by city or even zip code for groups seeking the different kinds of assistance. There are various ways to help virtually and in person. Want to give some energy? Joe Houston, Jr., 27, Washington, D.C., is a fitness coach and community advocate. My mother died when I was 13, and I always say the street life was my father. I was incarcerated on a gun charge, and during my sentence, I got involved in fitness and working out. When I came home at 21 years old, I knew my purpose, to empower people through wellness. COVID-19 hit my neighborhood, Ward 8, didn't have the most cases in D.C., but we had the most deaths. There's only one grocery store and no gym. So in June, I started #WeFitDC, an initiative that aims to close the health and wellness gap in our district. I give free workout sessions to the community, and we have food drives with only nutritional options. Want to take action? Start a walking, running, or exercise group that's inclusive. Pay for a trainer or earn your own qualifications via the National Academy of Sports Medicine or the National Strength and Conditioning Associations. Want to give some guidance? Gerald Oda, 52, of Honolulu, Hawaii. He's an insurance investigator and a Little League coach. My older brother started coaching Little League after he graduated from the University of Hawaii, where he also played baseball. He asked if I wanted to join him, and I've been coaching now for more than 25 years. My team won the 2018 Little League World Series. I work from home, so that gives me flexibility. Practices are up to 2.5 hours long, 3 to 4 times a week, and it gives me something to look forward to. Want to take action? Coaching your kids' team is the gateway, but also check with your local rec department for opportunities. And the last one is give service. Jason Irby, 21, pro motorcycle racer, electrician, volunteer fireman, lives in Napa, California. In 2017, the Tubbs Fire in Northern California was less than 5 miles away from where I call home. I wanted to help, but I couldn't. So I became a volunteer firefighter with the Napa County Fire Department. With motorcycle racing, I'm thankful I've had success, but it's always been about me. But with firefighting, it's a complete opposite. The team environment and being able to support a community that I've grown up in is really what attracts me. The 2020 Glass Fire started a quarter mile from our fire station, and being able to drive up and down the road and see the buildings we did save made me really happy. Want to take action? Local fire departments help you find where you can get trained, and the American Red Cross organizes disaster response teams in times of need. And yup, you can give money. There are plenty of charities in the Fort Wayne and Allen County area that would like to have a little extra funding. Well, I'm going to share a couple quotes. You cannot have a positive life and a negative mind. Joyce Meyer. And Alicia Scalarene says, eating is not merely a material pleasure. Eating well gives a spectacular joy to life and contributes immensely to goodwill and happy companionship. It is of great importance to morale. Grow Harlem Brundtland said, health is the core of human development. And Marlene Dietrich said, it's the friends you can call up at 4 a.m. that matter. Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Tony Ray with Healthy Life. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
To bring us up to time for our next regularly scheduled program, we now bring you the following informative feature.
Hello, this is Kay, reading the Odessa American for Tuesday, February 9th, 2021. Booster vaccines begin February 15th at Urgent Cares. OA News at OAOA.com. While the COVID-19 vaccine first doses will still be available at Ratliff Stadium this Wednesday and Thursday, MCH officials say the booster or second shot will be administered starting Monday at urgent care clinics by appointment only. The second shot is for those who received the first shot at Ratliff Stadium during the last few weeks. Medical Center Health System has created a process for the community to receive their booster, second doses, shots of the Pfizer vaccines given at Ratliff Stadium, a news release details. The first booster shots will be available starting on Monday for those who received the first shot at Ratliff Stadium. Odessans can call 432-640-2747. That's 432-640-2747. That number is answered Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. and Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., which are also the same times to get the second shot at the Urgent Cares located at either 6030 West University Boulevard or 3001 JBS Parkway.
To bring us up to time for our next regularly scheduled program, we now bring you the following informative feature.
The Midland Unified Command Team will open a second mass vaccination site at Golf Course Road Church of Christ Family Center, 3500 West Golf Course Road, on February 15th. The Midland County Horseshoe Backstage location, 2514 Arena Trail, also will remain open for second dose administration. Those people who qualify as phases 1A, healthcare workers, or 1B,